This is April the 11th, 1996. We are working on tape 6 at Professor Mark Perlman's house for the National Council of Jewish Women. Howard Braun and Ruth Saul. Say a word, Dr. Perlman.
Good morning.
Pretty low, but maybe it's worth.
At our last meeting, we were discussing things that went on at Beth Shalom Synagogue, to which you didn't agree, and the reasons why you decided to leave there.
What year was that, Dr. Perlman?
I'm having trouble remembering the precise year. I should be able to work it out. But it was probably 5 or 6 years ago, so it would be around 1989 or 1990. I don't remember, because it has been several weeks since we talked precisely where we had gotten in the story. But as I reconstruct the story, I think I mentioned that I was taken out of the line of succession as president, not unwillingly, but I did not anticipate the degree of what is the word I would like to use, the degree of isolation that I encountered. I had been quite active as a member of the board. I'd been quite active as an officer. I had certainly been reasonably active on all aspects of the congregation that I might have been, perhaps with the exception of the men's club. In any event, it had been my experience that when one is either leaves office or is taken out of the succession, there is a tendency to drop you. People do not appear to be as solicitous of your ideas, to say nothing of your feelings, as previously. And when that happened, I was not at all surprised, but I was rather surprised to see the degree to which I was avoided. I had asked if I could be on certain specific committees, and these requests were ignored. When the time came for the usual honors at the high holiday services, the honors which I had dispensed as chairman of the ritual committee for years, and I'd always been very careful to see that everyone was included, I was ignored. These were irritants. They, to say that they were major irritants is only to tell part of the story. Originally, they were not a major irritants, but after 2 or 3 years, they began to be major irritants. I think the thing that bothered me the most in this isolation was that, as I mentioned, I think earlier, Rabbi Steindl had asked me to organize Professor Brian Cantor's participation in a Slichus service, and I had said that Cantor was of sufficient stature that he should not share the podium with other speakers, and for that reason Rabbi Steindl thought that they would go on to others. Which, again, a decision with which I was not in agreement, but one which was not the least bit offensive. However, we had invited Rabbi Steindl for dinner, which we had set up for Professor Cantor and Professor and Mrs. Cantor. And less than 24 hours before the dinner was to be had, Rabbi Steindl called and said that he had decided to spend the evening with his children. And I felt that the that this was a kind of manifestation which bothered me excessively. This is not, in my belief, an adequate explanation for not attending a dinner that you have an exception invitation you've previously accepted. If one assumes that there was a domestic crisis and it was necessary for some reason or other to spend the evening with the children and you did not want to give the details of the domestic crisis, you would simply say something has come up and I can't be there. Alternatively, if you intend to give what is essentially a weak excuse, the weakness of the excuse is an essentially a revealing thing. Now, I may be wrong on this, and I will go on to tell a story which I suppose may be out of bounds. My cousin, Judith Martin, considers herself to be, and is considered by many to be, one of the country's great experts on manners, accepted an invitation to a Seder at my brother-in-law's, Mordecai Waxman's, and a week before the Seder, she called to beg off, using as the excuse that her husband, who's an amateur playwright, or rather a distinguished scientist at the National Institutes of Health, but nonetheless an amateur playwright, had been offered a chance to give a reading. Later I mentioned to Judith that no excuse was better than that excuse. And she said, why? I said, because you are revealing that you consider his creativity to be superior to a major Jewish religious event. The Seder is a major Jewish religious event in the annual calendar. And she said, isn't it? And I said, no, it is not, not to a rabbi. And she said, well, that's a matter of opinion. And I said, Judith, you're justifying yourself. You're wrong. You want to know that you're wrong. No excuse is better than that excuse. Well, this happened, and at that point I decided that there was just no purpose whatsoever continuing membership. And I called up the administrator of the synagogue, a man who had come in since the time that I had been an officer, and identified and said that I was resigning membership. And that everybody would be happier if they knew it, because then they would not be wasting time and effort to get my dues. And I choose not to remember his name, or in any case to give it at this point. And his reply was, "Who are you again?" And I thought, well, if the executive director asks me, "Who are you again?" I guess my point is made. Well, that having been decided, then the question came as to where we would join, and it seemed to me that the obvious place to go would be to the Tree of Life. My daughter...
Oh, excuse me. Did anybody try to retain?
Rabbi Steindel called me several times and said that I had given money at different times for plaques for members of my family and for seats in the sanctuary, as it's called. And he said they were not going to take our names off of our seats in the hopes that we would reconsider. But I said there was little chance of that. Perhaps a derivative question that you might have asked is, did he know the reason why I was angry? I thought I tried to indicate it to him, but several years later, he asked my brother-in-law why my nose was out of joint. And Rabbi Waxman said to him that Perlman thought that this was not an acceptable set of relationships. And I was not present at the conversation insofar as it was related to what my brother-in-law told me. Apparently, at a certain point in the conversation, Rabbi Waxman said to Rabbi Steindel, "You have to remember, Steve, that Professor Perlman is a very distinguished man. and that you may not think that he is that distinguished, but other people do think so, and he handles himself that way, to react as you reacted was simply an indication that you didn't take him at his own value. And he may have an exalted value of himself, or he may not. But whether it is exalted or it is not exalted, it is a value that he places on himself, reinforced by how other people have treated him. Oh, Steindl, well, he sees me on the street. He is always a hail fellow, well met. But I have not, there is no question in my mind that I would not reconsider my decision. Mm-hmm. Al Smolivar saw me at one point and said that he and Harriet Truman wanted us to come to a weekend retreat which was being held someplace. And he said this was a confrontation in one of the local supermarkets. And I said, no, I didn't think we would come. And he said, well, why not? Your friends will be there. And I said, no, Al, I know who my friends are, and I know who my friends are not. You don't have any illusions that I think you're my friend. And my wife later remonstrated with me and said this was no way to talk to him. But from my standpoint, after that event, there was no more effort to either to smooth things over or more likely to forget the past. Mm-hmm. In any event, we went to Tree of Life. Rabbi Birkin had handled conversion classes of my daughter's husband, Kenneth Williams, and I thought that he handled it well. Williams' attitude towards conversion was a good one. However, I think that Williams, like my cousin Judith Martin, does not take the rabbinical function as seriously as I think he should have. In any event, we approached Rabbi Birkin and said that we would like to join Tree of Life. We joined Tree of Life. Rabbi Birkin then asked me to be a member of the Adult Education Committee, and I went on the committee. There I came up with several ideas which were accepted in principle and were implemented. But in the process of implementation, I recognized that I was coming on far too hard. I had suggested that the adult education program that year focus on the topic of Jacob, and particularly the problems in Judaism that the Jacob story engendered. And the topic was picked up, and the thing that was emphasized was Jacob and Joseph. The truth is that what I had in mind as more sophisticated was a topic of the role of Jacob in Jewish historiography. I'll tell a story to make this point, because it's one which I think is extraordinarily interesting. An English cleric in the 1930s by the name of Ing, he was the dean of a cathedral.
His name is Ing, I-N-G-E, Dean Ing,
preached a sermon, which I've always thought was one of the most interesting Christian sermons in this century. He said, Esau was like an English gentleman. He was a hunter. He liked the outside. He was honest. He was open. He was hearty. He was a good man. He was an English gentleman. On the other hand, his brother Jacob was a sneaky little Jew. He was crafty. He was less than honest, certainly not open. Yet, said Dean Ng, God enjoins us to admire not Esau, but Jacob. Is that not strange? He says at the end of his sermon. Is that not strange? Now, the reason why I'm so fascinated with Jacob is that I think that from a theological standpoint, Jacob is in many ways the prototypical, represents the prototypical difference between Jews and Christians. For years, have told my students the story of Jacob wrestling with the angel, which I think is the prototypical Jewish approach. You'll recall that Jacob has gone to sleep, and he dreams, or in any case, he appears to dream, that he is wrestling with an angel. It's more than a dream, because in the process of the wrestling, the angel wounds Jacob, and Jacob is never able again to walk without a limp. But in the morning, when the sun comes up, Jacob says to the angel, the morning has come, I must go on my way, bless me before we part. Now, bless me before we part is simply a form of saying, the fight is over. When I turn my back, you will not jump me, because bless me means I have your approval, and you will, and the thing is over. And at that point, the angel, and I use that word angel in double quotes, the angel says to Jacob, you are no more Jacob, you are now Israel. And so the argument is that if Jacob was not wrestling with an angel, Jacob was wrestling with God. Now the important part of the story is that the fact that God hurt Jacob does not come as any surprise. What is important, and the fact that Jacob can't hurt or pin God doesn't come as a surprise. But what is important is that God wasn't able to pin Jacob. He hurt him, but he wasn't able to pin him, that is, to finish the fight. And this is a sort of a Jewish view that a man can have an exchange with God and leave the fight with the respect of God, and without having succumbed to God's strength. Man's strength is that strong. Now that was what I thought would be the interesting theological argument. But as I say, the group went for discussion largely of Joseph. And there were several excellent sessions in that series. One of them, I asked Professor Tobias from the English Department of the University of Pittsburgh to give a summary and a discussion of the Joseph series by Sholem Ash, ASCH, which was a set of books written in the 1930s. Which was a retelling of the Joseph saga with considerable embellishment, was sort of a type of midrashic, M-I-D-R-A-S-H-I-C, embellishment. I also asked that we get a psychiatrist to come and talk about sibling rivalry, because a great deal of the Joseph story is simply seen in terms of the relationship with the brothers. The cantor at that time, a man whose name I again have chosen to forget, and I squared off when I said that I thought that he should put on musical Joseph and His Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. He said that he was pretty busy anyway, and I said, well, I didn't care why you were pretty busy anyway. It struck me as a very good idea. Well, he went ahead and did it, and it was apparently a horrendous success.
It was.
It's the kind of thing which makes young people identify with the Joseph story, and it certainly has as many singable tunes as anything that has come out in recent decades. The following year, the president of the congregation and Rabbi Birkin asked me if I would take over the adult education committee. And I said that no, I would not, that I had thought that I did not have the personal leadership qualities to be able to cope with the sensitivities of the longtime members of that committee, that I had reviewed the whole experience I had of selling this idea and had recognized that there were several difficulties. Nobody disputed the virtue of the idea. Certainly it worked out very well, but there was a great deal of resistance to the notion that I was changing the direction of the committee. I was a newcomer coming in and taking over, and I thought that the likelihood of getting any cooperation was small. Moreover, and I mention this here because this is a record, the way to have done that, in my view, was to have said, why don't you come on the board for a year or two and then take over the chairmanship of the committee? Because as a member of the board, I could have had a kind of sense of derivative support from the board. But the woman who had been a member, the chairman of the committee, who I thought had been a relatively anxious about the degree of my domination.
Was it Ann?
I don't remember the name.
Okay.
No, it was not Ann, it was somebody else. Was a member of the board.
Yeah.
And it was not the way that I thought things ought to be done. In any event, as I said to the rabbi and the president of the congregation, I'm obviously flattered that you like the program, and I'm obviously aware that I have a very strong conviction that adult education programs are one of the two or three most understressed elements of any synagogue program that I know of, but I'm not really going to devote time or the concern that was desirable. Now, there are other matters that I have that were involved here, which I perhaps mentioned before. I think that my feelings about Tree of Life had never been particularly strong. As I mentioned, when I was in Baltimore, I appreciated the sermons, but a sermon to me is not a drosha. It's not simply an explanation of a particular ethical point. A sermon usually has a minimum of 5 points and a minimum of 2 themes, perhaps even 3 themes. And the whole purpose of a seminar is to lay out these themes and then reintegrate them at the end of the sermon so that you see them from a different standpoint than you did originally. And such a sermon requires no less than 30 minutes and more frequently closer to 50. The tradition at Tree of Life is to have a service which should last no more than 2 hours and 5 minutes.
Less.
And my own feeling is that the other element of the Shabbat service, which I find very interesting, is the Torah reading, the reading of the Haftorah. But the Tree of Life uses the triennial cycle, a cycle, by the way, which was traditionally, traditional cycle in the biblical period. The notion of the full reading of the Tanakh each year is more recent. The major difficulty with the short reading is that usually as the Tanakh is laid out, one third of the portion is too short a section to make any to set up full discussion of the points that are being made. Unfortunately, as I've become older, I've come to realize that the Amida, which is the central prayer in both the morning service and in the additional service, leaves me relatively cold. I suppose this is a product of an inadequate Jewish training as a child. Whatever the case is, many people go to the synagogue because they find that the recitation of the Shemona Esrei, the Amida, is a meaningful thing to them. It is not meaningful to me. The formulas I do not find intellectually or emotionally challenging. What I do find, have found challenging by and large, have been, as I say, the sermons or the Torah and Haftorah readings. Well, the sermons at Tree of Life, I think, are not sermons. Essentially, they are drushes, simply a statement on a point. Rabbi Birkin has, it seems to me, an impossible task. He cannot work out a sermon in the amount of time that the congregation wants him to speak. In addition to which, he wasn't hired as a deliverer of homilies or sermons. And I don't know that he has a taste for that sort of thing. Perhaps Rabbi Friedhof at Lod of Sholem not only had a taste but had considerable capacity for working out sermons. But even in the case of the times that I heard Rabbi Friedhof, I thought that the craftsmanship in his sermons was excellent, but that the content was thinner than I would have preferred. Now, when I say the content is thinner, I don't mean to suggest that Rabbi Friedhof was not capable of much better content, but the congregation has a taste for a level of content. And if the congregation is impatient, it's sort of like saying to someone of the order of Beethoven or Mozart or Bach, we give you 6 minutes to work out a cantata, or 6 minutes to work out a symphony, or 6 minutes to work out a complete musical presentation. And the best they can do is to come out with a hymn. Bach was able to do it in 6 minutes, but it's there are very few equivalents in the contemporary rabbinical ranks of the kinds of ability that Bach could do. In any event, that is, in time, as time has gone on, I have come to recognize that synagogal affiliation is something in which I believe in principle, and I continue to allocate a fair amount of charitable funds for that purpose. But I have not found in the synagogues in Pittsburgh the kind of intellectual or social response which, or perhaps I should put it the other way around, I've not found the kinds of social or intellectual response, that is to say, the Beth Sholem and the Tree of Life in that order, response that I would have liked. I found Cantor Taube's liturgical music very interesting, and interesting to the point of going to the service to hear what he could do, or chose to do. The cantor at the Tree of Life, a woman, has a very pleasant voice, but from a standpoint of musicology, she is not in, I don't know if she practices or pretend to be in the class of Cantor Tobe. Is there anything else that I should say on the synagogal front? The last story that I did want to refer to was that shortly before I left Beth Sholem, the officers came to me and said, would I lead a symposium of different rabbis in Pittsburgh talking about their views of Judaism. I anticipated that this was an effort to reincorporate me, but since none of the officers ever came to any of the sessions, I came of the view that what it was a hot potato, which they figured if anybody got burned handling, it better be me. Mm-hmm. In any event, it was a very interesting experience that we asked a variety of rabbis to come and talk about what Judaism meant to them.
What do you mean a variety? What sort?
Oh, well, rabbis ranging from...